This is the Elevate Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
Today's episode of the Elevate Podcast is being brought to you by Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is award-winning case management software used to manage personal injury, medical malpractice, MDL, class action law firms all over the United States. Great program, highly recommend it. Check them out at smartadvocate.com. Today's episode is being brought to you by Expert Institute. Expert Institute is the place to go for everything involving experts to help you win your case. Check them out at expertinstitute.com. And today's episode is being brought to you by Hype Legal. Hype Legal is a one-stop shop for all of your digital marketing needs. Check them out at hypelegal.com.
Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. I'm Rahul Ravipudi.
I'm Ben Gideon. So Rahul, we haven't seen each other since your last trial and your really amazing verdict. Congratulations, first of all. It's an incredible result.
Oh, thanks, Ben. Thank you. We haven't seen each other in a while, though. It's been a little too long. Where have you been traveling?
I have, and you have, actually. What I find interesting is you always plan these vacations for right after your trials. So what I like about that is it demonstrates that you have a ton of confidence that you're going to win, because it would probably be miserable to go on vacation if you lost, and then you'd be wallowing throughout the vacation. It would be miserable for your family to be with.
Oh, 100%. But on this one in particular, I didn't know if I was going to make the vacation. We ended up going to Jordan. My wife plans all of our trips, and for many years, and I'm sure this was with you as well, Ben, and probably every trial lawyer, if you plan a vacation when you don't think you're going to be in trial, you'll never plan a vacation. So she just books it. And if it works out, it works out. And if it doesn't, it doesn't. But a 20-hour flight to Jordan, if I was defensed, would have been an absolutely miserable flight. So really happy for the outcome.
So we're going to do a special episode devoted to breaking down your trial, but just give us the headline of it.
The headline is, I represented this nice young man, Jack Greener. He was 23 at the time of the injury-causing event, and he was a white belt in jiu-jitsu, and he was taking a class. And at the end of the class, there's a short bit of sparring. And so he was sparring with his second-degree black belt instructor, and the instructor decided to do a pretty advanced move wrong on my client, and in doing so, broke his neck, rendered him an incomplete quadriplegic. The case really involved that claim of negligence and the issues of assumption of risk and all of the things that come with it. The defense was going for a 100% defense verdict, didn't think the case had any merit. After about a month-long jury trial, jury came back with a $46.5 million verdict for my client.
That really is amazing. What a great result, and sounds like a very worthy client.
No, absolutely. He's a great, great kid. And he's actually an absolute inspiration for the spinal cord injured community. One of his goals after getting injured, when he had no movement in his limbs, he had his dad record a video of him, which he posted on Instagram, telling everybody what happened to him, and said, "Don't worry, everybody, I'm going to walk again." And then he set a goal for himself. He said, "Not only am I going to walk again, I'm going to climb Mount Whitney." And so he slowly started regaining some movement in his limbs, went to Craig rehab facility out in Colorado, spent 4 months of super intense rehab there, and then regained some ability to walk, started training, and ultimately climbed Mount Whitney with a huge support cast. There's a documentary done about him.
Wow.
And he has a huge following and is really saved a lot of young people from suicide and serious mental health issues by giving them some hope that their life could come back in some way. So a really, really special young man.
Well, that's amazing. And that's a great teaser for the next episode where we're going to break down that verdict and get into some detail and hear all about it. Can't wait to do that. But today, do you want to introduce our guest, Rahul?
Yeah, I guess I'll do this. So I have the pleasure of
fellow Californian.
Yeah, not only a Californian, Harry Plotkin lives within spitting distance of my house. And so we're neighbors, friends, and he is a really amazing jury consultant who's helped plaintiff trial lawyers all over with jury selection, trial strategy, and helping them achieve amazing outcomes for their clients. Hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars on multiple verdicts and some of the best known verdicts here in the state. So Harry, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure being here with you guys. And congratulations.
Not only are you joining us, you're actually joining us at my house. So thanks for coming over and then doing the podcast early in the morning.
Absolutely. Happy to help me. I got young kids at home that if they even hear me whisper, would probably wake up at 5:30 in the morning. So it's a pleasure being here. Congrats on the verdict. For those of you who aren't familiar with California, San Diego is a very conservative venue. It's not like Los Angeles where they're just handing out huge verdicts all the time. It's just such a tough conservative venue with jurors who are happy sometimes to give you $10,000 for pain and suffering in a car accident case. So it was incredible.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, I'm just, you know, one of the things we like to do is find out a little bit about guests so that our listeners can kind of understand who you are and where you're coming from. I'm always interested in people that get into your line of work, helping lawyers with juries, jury consulting, selection, psychology. It's such a niche in a way that how did you get into that? What's your background?
Sure. My background is in cognitive psychology and how people make decisions. But like pretty much every jury consultant I've ever met, I fell into doing this. I didn't know it was a field that existed. I don't have any drawings of me in crayon when I was a kid as me as a jury consultant. So I have this background in psychology. Initially out of school, I was working for some expert witnesses, economists, crunching numbers for them that they were testifying on. And so one of the lawyers that was hiring us was nice enough to ask me, hey, could, you know, you have this background in psychology. Could you help us, you know, how do we explain this stuff to jurors and how do we, it's so complicated. So I was helping design demonstratives and helping him with themes before I even knew what themes were. And eventually one of these lawyers that was, I was helping was nice enough to tell me, you know, this is a real field that you're kind of doing. And I had no idea. And then just by total coincidence, several months later, a friend of mine was starting and founding a new jury consulting company from an old existing jury consulting company and asked me to join him. And so it was fascinating to me. And I joined him and spent the first few years just kind of in the background, going to focus groups and trials and soaking up everything I could before I became a consultant myself. So totally fell into it, but loved it. And the thing that I love the most about it that I'm sure you guys love about being trial lawyers too, is that you have to be incredibly competitive to do it. You can't be afraid of winning or losing. And for me, picking a jury and going to trial with a lawyer is the closest that I've experienced as an adult to playing youth sports and being competitive. So you really have to love it. And so that's how I fell into it. I just love the winning and losing and loved helping people. And it took me a while before I started working exclusively with plaintiffs because at the beginning, I would just take whoever hired me. I would work 50-50 plaintiff defense. I would work out of any state. So it took a while before I figured out some of these cases make me feel a little bit better about myself than others. And some of these cases I kind of I'm rooting for a lot more than others. And when I realized that, it was a no-brainer that to work on the plaintiff side.
So, well, how many jurors over your career have you interacted with, prospective jurors?
Oh, gosh. Total jurors. I mean, it's got to be, I can't even done that math. I mean, it's hundreds and hundreds of, I'm sure over 1,000 focus groups. And I've participated in probably about 750 jury selections. So, I mean, it's probably in the hundreds of thousands of actual jurors.
And then over how many years?
I spun off my own practice in 2006 and I was consulting for a couple of years before then. So about 19 years of me actually being the consultant.
So I don't know why in all the times we've hung out, I haven't asked you this, but have you seen any changes in the way that jurors behave than juror psychology over the years?
For sure. Yeah. And I think the biggest shift that I have ever seen is over the last few years since COVID. And I have my theories on why jurors have been so much more receptive to giving big verdicts. I mean, someone should do a research project on it. But that's the biggest shift that I've seen, is that all of a sudden people really don't have they don't give the benefit of the doubt to big companies. They get very, very angry if they see a big company acting irresponsibly and making excuses. You saw a very small percentage of the juror pool feeling that way and being willing to talk about, let's give a $100 million verdict. I mean, sometimes that would happen. You get one juror on a panel saying that, and then the others would say, ah, come on. And then they have to compromise. But now you just see so many more. And I think it's because you saw so many companies during COVID doing so well while people weren't doing so well. You just saw people kind of losing their patience with the way that they were being treated. There's a lot of things I think that happened, but that was by far the biggest shift that for me has totally changed my approach to jury selection. And because my approach now is probably even more so, how do we keep the good jurors than how do we identify and get rid of the bad ones? You still obviously have to get rid of the bad ones. I mean, there's still bad jurors out there. I just haven't seen such a seismic shift in how jurors thought for the first 15 years of my career compared to the last couple.
I'm interested in getting into some of the details of how you work. But before we get into that, kind of on a macro level, rather, do you have any sort of overarching philosophy in terms of how you approach juror selection, juror psychology?
Sure. Yeah, that's a great question. I would say that my main philosophy is that people as jurors all want to do the right thing. They all want to follow the law. I don't think there's that many jurors that just disregard the law and just do whatever they want to do. But people are going to do their values tell them to do. I mean, people, when they interpret the law or they interpret a contract or they interpret anything, they're going to put their own spin on it. I mean, that's what cognitive psychology tells us about confirmation bias and all those things. And people, you know, view everything through the filter of their lives and their values. And so you have to really understand people's values and what gets them upset rather than expecting people to just follow the law. And that's one of the main things that I teach lawyers in jury selection is, don't ever assume that they're just going to, you know, you're going to tell them what the law is and they're going to say, okay, I'm upset this company violated the law. People are only going to be upset by the things that get them personally upset. And I also believe that jurors are, and big verdicts, I mean, they're more motivated by anger and disgust and things like that than they are by sympathy. I mean, certainly jurors feel sympathy, and certainly there are a lot of jurors who feel very sympathetic for plaintiffs. But the really big verdicts, when a jury's looking at a case, they're really weighing, like, how much does this defendant really deserve to have to pay a big verdict? When jurors are looking there and they're valuing death or they're valuing an injury and things like quality of life, pain and suffering, money's not going to bring a person back or money's not going to fix this problem. I mean, $100,000 or $1 million or $50 million. I mean, it's all, what I found is that for jurors, the difference is, how much does this defendant really deserve to have to pay this? They really want to find defendants fully accountable. And that's a phrase, we'll talk about that later. That's a phrase that I've been using a lot and having lawyers use that a lot in voir dire and opening and closing. But I've just found that when jurors feel like it was just an honest mistake, and even though the defendant was technically negligent, it was just an honest mistake and they didn't mean to hurt anybody and they weren't really being intentionally careless, you tend to get a lot of defense verdicts or small verdicts. And when they feel like someone really knew what they were doing, get these huge verdicts. The size of the defendant and the wealth of the defendant does matter to them, no matter what you tell them. I always used to always make this little joke when I would teach at seminars, and I don't know if judges liked it very much, but I would always say, does everyone here know the reason why there isn't a camera in the deliberation room, the jury room? It's because every trial would probably be a mistrial, because if you've watched a focus group, there's just always something that they say. There's always some anecdote they use or something. It's impossible for jurors to be completely sanitized. And I'm not saying that you should ever encourage them to not follow the law. You should, but to expect them to follow the law is very difficult. They're always going to just revert back to doing, you know, what they think is fair, what they think is right.
I suspect that many of our listeners, even if they're experienced trial lawyers, have never actually worked with a jury consultant. They've attempted to learn what they can about how to manage voir dire. They've done it on their own. Why should lawyers reconsider that? What value can you bring to the case that a lawyer, even if they study up, bring to it themselves?
You know, I think the main thing is just reps. And we do this so often. I mean, between my wife and I, we probably select 70 to 80 juries a year. And we see double that in focus groups. And we just have seen so many people responding to so many the same issues over and over again that we kind of know which things really matter when the jurors are talking in voir dire. We know how they're going to react to certain issues and how different people are going to react. You know, I think also which pieces of conventional wisdom about jurors and jury selection are true and which ones are not so true. I mean, there's a lot of things that we hear that have been passed down over the generations that we hear from lawyers that just are not true. And in fact, are the opposite. And there have been a lot of times when we've explained something to an attorney and they said, oh my gosh, I've been doing it the exact opposite for years and years. And sometimes they say, gosh, I remember I kept someone like that on the jury and they turned out they were awful. And I always thought they were good. So
can you give us some examples of maybe some of that conventional wisdom that you think is incorrect?
Sure. I mean, probably the best example of it is demographics being really important. But the most interesting one probably is, for example, in an employment case, there's always this thinking that, hey, if I'm a plaintiff lawyer who does employment, I want jurors who have been mistreated by their employers. And or if I'm a personal injury lawyer on the plaintiff side, I want somebody who's been injured, who's going to understand pain and suffering. And actually, those things tend to make jurors pretty bad. But I've seen a lot of attorneys wanting those people. And hey, I want people who filed lawsuits before. And they're going to be great. But the problem with that is that in employment, that tends to get people very cynical. If somebody has been mistreated by employers over and over again, they actually end up being some of your worst jurors. They get very cynical about how fair the working world should be. And they kind of go, big deal. This happens all the time. I'm not offended by it. You know, in personal injury, people who've been injured, even if they're sympathetic, even if they're great jurors, I always tell lawyers, I mean, they tend to be low damage a lot of times, unless they're the most sweet, wonderful, empathetic person in the world. Somebody who has had a similar injury or they have a relative with a similar injury is going to say, you know, I mean, it's bad, but it's not the worst thing in the world. It's not the end of your life. The highest damage juror is going to be somebody who says, I can't imagine that happening to me. Oh my gosh, they're horrified and they're shocked. And I can't imagine what it's like to go through that. Somebody who understands what it's like to go through that, even though they may have some empathy, is going to say, you know, is that $10 billion worth? I mean, I deal with it all the time. People with back injuries and a back injury case are usually pretty bad for you, pretty low damage. Another one is, you know, oh, I want people who are going to kind of relate or identify with my client. And defense lawyers are guilty of this all the time. They always want to strike somebody. You know, if you represent a motorcyclist, they want to strike all the motorcyclists on the panel because they're worried they're going to identify with your client. And usually it's actually, those are the jurors who are the most judgmental and critical of your client. And so, and there's a ton I could go on about things, but for me, understanding the things that matter and the things that don't matter and the things that are just kind of myths about jury selection and things that really are true is a huge part of helping us focus lawyers on what matters in jury selection.
And that's the kind of the hard part too, is on those examples for somebody who suffered a back injury, there may be somebody who suffered a back injury and it was by no fault of somebody else. That may impact the way they see the case, or it was the fault of somebody else. And then they made a claim and said, I just got my medical bills and I'm really happy. And so those are the pieces of information that may dictate whether they're going to be looking at non-economic damages as unreasonable on their face or the opposite. So, and that's probably what you have to sift through as a jury consultant and figuring out if that's going to be a fair juror for whatever case you're on.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I always teach that experiences, your jurors' experiences matter a lot and you want to find out about those. But what really matters is how did those experiences shape their expectations? Because and a lot of times that kind of works the opposite way. One example that I use a lot is people who have had really kind of not great medical treatment tend to be really bad for you in med mal cases. Because somebody, for example, who has been at the ER and been ignored for hours and hours, are they going to get offended when this doctor didn't run the test for that they should have run immediately? It was a 20-minute delay. I mean, they're going to go, that's just how it is. I want people who've been treated really well by doctors who are going to say, my expectation for doctors is really high. My standards are really high. And so really, ultimately, that's what matters is what are their expectations and their standards for the defendants, what they should have done.
On the flip side of that, are there things that have tracked generally well for good plaintiff's jurors?
You mean in terms of what kinds of things are you looking for in a good juror?
If someone was behind a curtain and you could only know one thing about them, and then had to choose one thing, would you want to know? Or a couple things, let's say.
Right. So it's different for every case. And I always, and it's so interesting. So I'll occasionally see the same focus group jurors more than once and I'll sometimes do online case studies where I'm, and sometimes I do this intentionally, where I'll have the same huge pool of people and I have the same folks. And you would be shocked that if you're a lawyer thinking some jurors are just good plaintiff jurors and some jurors are just defense jurors, and that's just kind of how it is. You would be shocked at how much they can back and forth depending on the case. The same juror who you might have seen in a focus group, who you're going, oh my gosh, that's the worst juror in the world. You know, they defensed the crap out of that case. They didn't even care. It was a great case and they just defensed it. Can be a great juror in a different case. But the one thing that I think is the most important for me is jurors is having a really strong conscience, being a Boy Scout about whatever your case involves, safety or fairness or employee rights or whatever, driving safety. I mean, I'm always looking for someone that I call a Boy Scout juror. That's somebody who doing the right thing really matters to them. They always do the right thing. They expect other people to do the right thing. Not a cynical bone in their body, who are going to be really, really offended by somebody who cut corners or did something they weren't supposed to do.
How do you elicit that in voir dire? What's been the best approach for doing that?
Asking them open-ended questions on the kind of key points of the case. And open-ended questions are so important. I mean, it's so easy for jurors to kind of hide in behind yeses and nos, especially when they know what the safe answers are. But I always love to ask at least a few questions about the really critical issues where I gauge them. And I always like to phrase it kind of, what are your feelings about whether this or that? And so, you know, one example is I recently did a dangerous condition case where we asked, what are your feelings about whether property owners have to be proactive about inspecting, doing regular maintenance and inspections versus waiting for someone to report, a tenant or something to report that there's a problem and then coming out then. And it was funny, we asked that question and the jurors started, it was one of the few times I've seen jurors to start arguing with each other for a while. The judge was actually really shocked by this. Because one guy who was just an awful juror for us who said something like, he was a property manager and he said, you know, there's only a couple of things that I do and check the furnaces or something. I can't remember what it was, you know, every once a year. But he said, frankly, if that wasn't required, I would stop doing that tomorrow. And some other jurors were sitting there arguing, and he was arguing with other jurors. And the other jurors were going, are you kidding? You have to go out there every so often and do maintenance. How else do you know that there's a problem? And some of the other jurors jumped in and said, yeah, but how? And this was against the city. And one of the jurors said, well, how are they supposed to monitor every square inch of their property and every tree and everything? And then another juror jumped in and said, they have maintenance departments. That's their job. That's what they do. And so asking them just sort of, you know, these open-ended questions about what they think that these types of defendants should do is really important. You know, the key question that I asked in the jury selection that I had, the lawyer, obviously, David G. Robertus, a good friend of mine, asked in the big verdict he had last year against SoCal Edison. It was a whistleblower retaliation based on kind of sexual harassment and toxic workplace case. I had him ask, let's say that a company has great policies and training, you know, zero tolerance on things like sexual harassment. Do you think that they've done their job by training the employees and telling them these are the rules? Or do you think that, you know, is that enough? Or do you think that they should have to actually go police and monitor the workplace to make sure that those rules are actually being enforced? And that was a huge question. I loved it. And we had some jurors who were absolute Boy Scouts saying, no, that's not, you can't trust these folks to just follow the rules. You got to actually go into the workplace and find out what's going on. And some folks were going, what else can you do? I mean, they're rogue employees. I mean, you made the rules clear. They don't follow them. That's on them. So really kind of understanding, I just love to hear what jurors have to say in these open-ended questions to really, for me to gauge whether this person is going to be, are they going to be upset at this defendant or are they going to, you know, make excuses and be okay with whatever they did or didn't do.
Now on that particular case, a $500 million verdict, were a number of jurors excused for cause or was that just a question that led to exercising peremptories? How did that work?
Sure. In that case, the defense actually got probably five times as many cause challenges as we did. We got very few cause challenges. We just kind of used our peremptories, I think, really well. And one thing that we did in that case, there was a lot of anti-corporate anger from the jurors that kind of got raised. And they got a lot of those folks off for cause. We battled with them and tried to convince as many as we could that they could be fair and they could kind of set that aside and everything. And I can explain later if you want how we did that. But yeah, they actually got most of the cause challenges in that case. But one thing that happened is that when you frame bias for jurors at the beginning of voir dire, and you explain to them that, for example, that being upset when companies don't treat their workers fairly, that's not a bias. That's having a conscience. As long as you base it on the evidence of what they did, you can be fair. That's not an issue. And so we did lose a lot. I mean, there's a lot of people who probably frankly didn't want to be there. It was like a 5 or 6 week trial. And there were a lot who were just really angry. But saying that convinced a lot of the other jurors to kind of, I mean, they just kind of didn't express any bias to the defense. I mean, they just kind of said, no, I could be fair. I'm going to judge you based on what you did. I'm not going to, which is true. I mean, I agree. I mean, That's the one thing that really troubles me is when, you know, and you guys probably see this too, really nice jurors, plaintiff jurors, tend to be a little more, for me, a little more honest. And they tend to be a little bit more likely to, even when they're not biased, to kind of say, I don't think I can be fair. This kind of subject really upsets me. And so a huge part of what I think is really important to do is to try to convince those folks, just because a subject upsets you doesn't mean you're biased. That's really not a bias. Jurors really do get confused about the difference between having a conscience and being biased. And so a big part of what I like to do in these cases is to have the lawyers explain that. And, you know, and I call it kind of prehabbing, because the defense gets a chance to rehab jurors afterwards. We don't get the chance. We get up first, and then we don't get to get up again and try to rehab them again. So you only have really one shot to convince these folks. Just because you get upset at how some employers treat employees, or just because you get upset at how some companies sometimes cut corners on safety, that's not necessarily a bias if you are only getting angry at what someone specifically did. As long as you're going to give a fair shot to this defendant, give them a chance to prove to you they didn't do anything wrong. And the key question I'd love to ask at the end, just to wrap it up, is, you know, if the evidence in this trial convinces you that this company did absolutely nothing wrong, do they have any reason to worry about you as a juror? And, you know, the juror, when they get it, they kind of go, no, absolutely not. That particular case, I think getting some jurors to say that, the defense actually didn't end up not striking a few of them. Because, I mean, defense lawyers really love it when they hear a juror say, I'm just going to decide on the evidence. Then you ask me, you know, what's the profile of a really good plaintiff juror? I'll tell you that the profile is in the minds of defense lawyers for what they are looking for. They want someone who they think is super logical and rational and not going to get carried away by emotion. And so if they hear a juror, no matter what they feel about other things, say, I'm going to decide this based on the evidence and not make any assumptions. And they just, oh, that person's great. So that's what ended up happening in that case. So we had a real professional jury. I mean, two of our best jurors were a former COO of a company and a lawyer for the state of California were two of my favorite jurors in that case. And those are the kind of jurors that 10 years ago, I think a lot of plaintiff lawyers would be really afraid to keep on a jury, and defense lawyers would love to keep them. But I'm seeing over and over, you know, really professional jurors getting really upset, giving big verdicts.
What were the qualities of those individuals that made them good jurors? I mean, other than the outcome of the case, obviously.
You know, I think just having, a really good, conscience about some of the issues in the case and expecting companies to monitor the workplace. And I can't remember exactly what the COO was my favorite juror. I really, really love that guy. You could just tell that even though he had a background in corporate, he really had high standards and really had some distaste for what some companies did. I remember him saying, he had been a juror before, but he'd been an alternate who couldn't deliberate. He ended up being our first alternate in that case. And he said, would like to be on this jury, but please, if you put me on this jury, please don't make me off. So I could tell he really was kind of chomping at the bit. You tell he was fascinated. He was really interested in the case. And he was our first alternate. So he came on real quick in that case. But just those folks just really not having a mindset where they were going to just buy into the excuses that employers would have. You could just tell that they were going to judge fairly to both sides. They were going to judge what this defendant did. And if you have a righteous case where a defendant really didn't do the right thing, you know, those kind of jurors are just going to get really, you know, really angry. You want people who are going to judge them on what they did, because you wouldn't be bringing a case if they didn't do something wrong.
Do you sit through a lot of trials from voir dire all the way through verdict?
Almost never these days. Or in the past, there were times where I'd be hired to do that. I will a lot of times sit through opening statements, and because a lot of research has shown that once you have your jury picked and once the jurors have heard your opening statement, you know, there's some number, you know, it's like 85% or 90% of the time they don't change their minds, which I think is actually true. And I test that. But once I've seen the openings, and especially what the other side is going to say, I'm not going to say the case is over, but that's all I need to know to kind of give them advice. And lawyers will call me, you know, during trial on an approach of witness, and especially for closing and things like that. But I always think those are the most interesting parts of the trial. Once the openings are given, I think the jurors have a pretty good sense of where they're leaning and what's going to happen, and knowing what the defense is. What they're saying can really inform me, give them advice on how to close in the case.
We'd like to thank the sponsors of the Elevate podcast, Steno, national court reporting service that allows trial lawyers to defer the costs of court reporting until the end of the case. Take a look, steno.com. And by Law Pods. Law Pods is the podcast production company that we use to produce the show, that produces podcasts for lawyers all over the country. They have an expertise in podcasting and the law. Check them out at lawpods.com.
Ben, I don't know if you experience this over on the East Coast as well, but a lot of the jurors I've been in front of recently, or maybe even over a lot of years, a lot of poker faces. It's like they come in very beginning of the trial, when opening statement starts, all the way through closing. Not a lot of indication one way or the other as to how they're feeling about the case. I was just wondering, Harry, is that just like the way the system is set up, that they're kind of wanting to be that way? Or is what I'm observing just not consistent with what's generally happening in each jury trial, or what?
You know, I think that that's something that I would say most juries kind of do have a poker face. From what I've seen, I think it depends a lot on the personality and the style of the lawyers. You know, Rahul, for you, I mean, you know, you're so professional and so prepared, and I could see, you know, your jurors take it being very serious and professional too. I know in David's case, he gets pretty animated. He was telling me that throughout the trial that these jurors were, he was sure that a bunch of them were in his favor. I mean, he was like saying they were rolling their eyes and laughing and, you know, doing and reacting. But I would say at least 90% of the time, I would say they're kind of doing what you're describing. I mean, it's when I check in with lawyers, it's more like, I don't really know what they're feeling. And I get a lot of lawyers saying, I'm really nervous because I feel like they're just a stone face and they're not smiling at me and they're not doing it. And I always tell them, don't worry about it. I mean, if jurors are upset and angry, they're not going to be necessarily smiling all the time. And I've had situations where the lawyers were really worried about a particular juror or two, and they ended up being great just because they had that poker face or really serious look on their face. So I don't worry too much about that. They usually, I think jurors doubt that, they usually feel empowered to just react as if they're, you know, at a baseball game or something. But San Diego in particular, I mean, you just came from a trial in San Diego. San Diego jurors are just notoriously very, very serious like that. I would be shocked to hear a San Diego jury reacting in trial too much.
Why do you think juries are so different in different locales around the country? There's a level in which you'd think people are people, right? And if you're trying the case in Los Angeles County or Cumberland County, Maine, people should view the same case in the same way. But the reality is that doesn't seem to be the case. So what do you think accounts for those differences?
That's a great question. I always operate, when I'm picking a jury or working in another state, I always operate under the assumption that people are people. There may be more of a particular type of person in a different state than in California. There may be more of that same bad juror that I see, you know, in California and in another state that's a little more conservative. But certainly they have different values. But I think from what I've seen that they don't necessarily react that differently. It's just, it's more the money issue, that sometimes just the value of money in different places is just so different. I've seen juries in other states and other venues get just as angry as a jury would in LA. But a jury in LA might say, this company is despicable, or $80 million, and a jury in, you know, Mississippi might say, this jury is despicable, $800,000. Because just in some places, that just money, the value of money to them is just very, very different. One thing I've noticed, though, is that this probably changed in the last couple of years, but I used to notice that kind of in the bigger cities, juries could give a really big verdict, but they wouldn't necessarily give a kind of verdict where they really felt like they were damaging the company. Sometimes I've seen in rural venues, they're more likely, because, you know, nobody there works in corporate offices and things like that. They don't mind just having some huge, in their minds, it's going to harm the company. My sense in San Francisco and Los Angeles and New York and Chicago, they're a little bit mindful of, okay, we don't want to put this company out of business or anything like that, or we don't want to affect the operations of the business. But I think that's why you see these big verdicts in places like these patent cases in East Texas, where all these patent cases get filed. They get chosen in those places because those places don't really care if companies at all or think about companies' welfare or anything like that. That's a great question. I mean, Ben, for you, do you feel like in Maine that the reaction of the jurors is different, or is it just the amount of money that they feel is appropriate?
I think it's probably mostly the money, as you've indicated. And we've done some of the big data studies, and our win rate among Maine jurors was equivalent to our win rate among a national demographic, but the numbers were considerably lower. So that's fairly anecdotal. It doesn't fully answer the question. I mean, I do think they're, just from my experience, they're harder liability jurors to some extent as well, but not probably as much as impacts on the damages side of the case.
And I wonder if some of that is because sometimes jurors get focused on this idea of why are we going to make this person rich, or why are we going to give this person money. And I wonder if sometimes they may not find fee on liability just almost because they don't want to give a person, you know, money if they don't really like the plaintiff and feel they deserve money, even if there is liability. That's why I think it's so important to kind of also in voir dire and and everything, and opening focus jurors on the idea that accountability and holding a defendant fully accountable is also a reason why the jury needs to give a verdict. Now, it's not, you obviously do it real carefully. You always have the lawyer say, hold this company or this defendant fully accountable for the harm that they caused. But one thing I found in the last couple of years that's just really shocking is talking to jurors and focus groups about not wanting to give money necessarily to a person. And this idea of holding a defendant fully accountable brings in a lot more jurors that are willing to give a lot of money that otherwise wouldn't. Now, I can't remember what trial it was. I wish I could remember, but I remember there was a trial where we had a juror, because jurors, when they're talking about money and non-economic damages and things like that, they never thought about these things before. You as lawyers and me as a jury consultant, I mean, we think about these all the time. Sometimes you have to explain it to them, and because they haven't really thought them through. And sometimes they'll just give these weird reactions like, oh, I don't, money for pain and suffering, it sounds ridiculous. But if you explained it to them, they might get it. But I remember there was a time where there was a juror that was really struggling. I just don't see how millions of dollars for someone's quality of life or pain and suffering, that doesn't make any sense. And I wrote a note to the lawyer saying, but the lawyer read it and said, well, if you don't give any money, that's the only claim in this case. And the defendant is not going to be held fully accountable unless. And then the juror thought about that and went, oh, that's a good point. Oh, yeah, I'm okay with it. For me, that was a huge shift that I realized that. And I started asking jurors in focus groups, and I would say, how do you feel about giving potentially, are you open to millions of dollars for pain and suffering? And jurors, a lot of jurors would say, I don't know about that. That sounds greedy. That sounds unfair. That sounds excessive. Well, how about millions of dollars for someone's quality of life? That's a phrase that I've been using for a little bit longer. And some of those same jurors, well, I could probably, oh, that makes kind of sense. I could do that. Well, how do you feel about holding the idea of awarding millions of dollars to hold a company fully accountable for the harm they caused? Oh, that sounds great. I could absolutely do that. And it's the same thing. It's just a difference of framing it a little differently. It's just weird how that full accountability and giving them that other reason in the back of their minds of why it's okay to give a lot of money and put up a big value, and thinking a little bit less of just making this plaintiff rich and a windfall and all these things. If you don't give people the full value of their harms, you're also not holding this company fully accountable. And so if you think that for a juror who thinks that pain and stuff, people shouldn't get money for those things, if that's the only harm in the case, then if you don't give it, then, you know, this defendant is not going to be held accountable at all. And those same jurors kind of go, oh, for me, that's been a huge game changer of talking about full accountability. And I wonder if in some of those other venues, bringing that in might bring in some more folks and make them more willing to award damages and, you know, more in places. Yeah.
I mean, what we deal with, it's different state to state, but in Maine, for example, where they've just started allowing attorney voir dire, every question gets put under the microscope. And the judge in my last trial literally screened each individual question virtually one at a time. Hmm. And I'm certain the judge would not have allowed that question because he would have perceived that as sort of crossing the line toward a punitive damages type argument, even though we didn't have a punitive damages claim, even though I don't believe it is, because part of tort damages, compensatory damages, is holding companies accountable. But you're not allowed to argue send a message in a non-punitive case. So
yes, yeah.
So where you have a system that allows you leeway and flexibility in framing your questions, you can ask better questions that get you better information. You know, we're always pushing the envelope on what's permitted and what's not. The system sort of conspires to only allow questions that produce the least value in terms of the responses.
I know, yeah.
For example, you know, the judges in our state really want you to ask questions that permit a yes or no answer, which, as you pointed out, is fairly worthless. But
do they let you follow up on?
They do, I mean, sometimes. But here's a question for you. If you have only a limited amount of time, because a lot of jurisdictions where our listeners practice, you know, they might get 15 minutes or 30 or 45 minutes. They don't get a half a day, full day, or a week or whatever. What's your advice to a lawyer that, let's say you have 30 minutes to do your voir dire? What would you do if you only had 30 minutes?
Would this be of the whole panel or just a small section of the panel? Because it depends on the number.
Let's make it reasonable. They put 22 people or 25 people in the box and you get 30 minutes.
Right. I would, and you know, we get this in
LA. I like that framing of let's make it reasonable. And yeah, but
I mean, okay, if there's 150 people, you might as well just go home probably, right?
Yeah. Or, I mean, in that situation, I'd probably say, hey, you know, let's do the math. You know, you really need to talk to the first 30 or 40 people. And if you're starting to get calls, then maybe move back. But I mean, that's not that dissimilar to what I'll do here. I mean, what I would do is I would say, let's keep this to 4 or 5 really key questions and try to get as much. I would rather go deeper on a couple of questions than try to ask, you know, 30 yes or no questions. And I think that's a mistake that a lot of lawyers do. They try to cover a lot of ground, like too much ground sometimes. They feel like they have to voir dire on every single issue in the case. But if you've ever picked a jury, I think you've probably noticed that as you start asking the questions, new topic, it's the same handful of bad jurors who just are raising their hand every single time. Sometimes you may get one person that surprises you, but for the most part, questions 1 to 3 tell you who the bad jurors are. And then questions 4 through 10 just tell you who the bad jurors are again and again and again. If you get that limit, I would just say just 2 or 3 questions that are really important to try, you know, even if it's just 1 or 2 questions, if you can talk to, I want to get an open-ended response from every person, maybe just 1 on liability and 1 on damages. And I've done that many times before where we get rushed by a judge. And I'll just say, just ask these 2 questions. Let's say each, you know, sometimes we'll have 18, a 6-pack in California, we're just talking 18 jurors at a time. It doesn't have to be, you don't have to spend a ton of time with them, but just get some answer on each one of these, 1 on liability, 1 on damages with them. 1 question about, what are your feelings about, you know, whether truck drivers need to be extra careful compared to regular drivers or not, or is that an unfair burden on them? And then a question about damages and what are your feelings? You know, sometimes I'll ask an open-ended question like, what are your feelings about whether you think the system, the idea of giving money to compensate for things like quality of life seems fair or important or excessive or pointless to you? And that's a real important one that I would like to ask because, and force the jurors to give a real honest answer because sometimes jurors will say, well, it depends. I'll do what law allows or I'm okay with it. And then I always have the lawyer say, yeah, well, I understand that. But what I'm asking is really how do you, not whether you could follow it, I'm sure you can, but what are your feelings about it? And so just for me, just 1 key question on liability, 1 key question on damages, but kind of getting a little deeper is what I'd want to know and telling, because just with one good answer on liability, I can tell you if I like a juror, you know, if they give a really great answer or if they give a really lousy answer, I don't really need to necessarily hear a ton more to say, that guy's pretty great and that guy's pretty bad.
Do you believe in pre-qualifying jurors for money?
What do you mean by that, for money?
Well, putting out there a number or range of what you expect to be asking for in the case and determining whether they'd be willing to consider, you know, if the evidence supported that type of a verdict, numbers in that range.
I don't have a problem with that. I think that's one of those things. Yeah, do you give a number, a specific number in voir dire, an opening, or do you not? Keep it more open-ended. I think there's no right or wrong way to do it. My preference is to not give a number. I prefer to kind of give a juror a sense of it, you know, in voir dire to talk about, you know, we think it's going to be many millions of dollars, or if you think it's going to be more than that, you know, tens of millions of dollars or whatever. I prefer not to give a specific number. I just think that creates a little bit of a weird impression with some jurors. Now, I know that some lawyers do a great job of putting it out there and using that to get a lot of cause because people, I could not give, you know, that specific amount of money. I just think there's a lot of jurors in the middle who could end up being okay jurors who just get rubbed a little wrong way by you being so specific when they don't kind of see a reason why yet. And jurors are weird about that. Jurors don't understand that these lawyers already know everything about this case. It's not like, but for them, when they hear you tell them what conclusions to draw at the beginning of an opening statement or money, they don't like to be told what to think or what the appropriate number is too much before they see the reasons for it. And so
what if you have an economic loss plan or life care plan for a specific number? Would you reference that at all in the voir dire or not?
Yeah, I was going to say for that, I'm okay with that. I'm more okay with that. And especially if it's a real big number that might surprise jurors. Yeah, I've certainly done that before and saying, you know, hey, especially in like a medical malpractice, birth injury or life care plan or something like that. And one thing I think is really important to talk about in cases like that, that I've seen be an issue with jurors is I always like to say, this is our only chance to ask for the money that this person's going to need. Unfortunately, the way the system works, we can't come back every few years, whether life expectancy is an issue or cost is an issue. You know, we can't come back every few years and just get what we need. Because sometimes jurors will ask that. I'm sure you guys, have you had jurors ask that question of like, why can't you just, we can't give you a little bit and then they come back. Why can't you just put, you know, the juror just say, well, whatever he needs. And then the court decides how much the person gets. Because they're always worried about, well, what if I give too much? But I always like to put in their minds, well, what if you give too little also? But yeah, to answer your question in a really long way, economic damages, you know, life care plan, I would, if it's a big number, I would mention it in voir dire.
Now, you were saying that
you know, at least as you're leaning on that specific number in voir dire or an opening statement, it could rub people the wrong way. Have you seen jurors actually react or communicate that to you, either through focus groups or prospective jurors who've gotten excused? What's your data points for that?
Certainly in focus groups, I've seen it where they kind of go, pull that number out of nowhere. Whereas when you wait till the end, they don't really have that reaction. When you've sold them, I mean, they're going, yeah. And the person says, I once had a case where we focus grouped it a couple times. And one time when I think the lawyer said something like $50 million at the beginning, and it just, these jurors had a negative reaction all throughout this $50 million. In another one where they didn't give the number at the end, and I was talking to them before, you know, how much money, and the person said, whatever, they'd already heard these awful facts, and they were like, whatever he wants, give it to him, you know? And I said, well, $50 million? Oh, absolutely, that's not enough, you know? And so now, I mean, part of voir dire is rubbing your badgers the wrong way, certainly. So that's why I kind of say, you know, there's some lawyers who do a great job, and I would never say never do it. Some lawyers do a great job of saying, we're going to be asking for $81.6 million in this case. And the jurors who kind of react, and some of the bad jurors, certainly, that's even easier to get them off. I could never award that much money. I'm just always worried that, are there going to be some jurors who are going to be a little, are not going to be on your side at the beginning, but you could get there, who you're going to lose because some jurors just don't think these things through, and they have a reaction. I picked a jury with a friend of mine in Santa Monica late last year, where I convinced him to keep a juror who said that she would have a cap of $2 million. It wasn't a well-thought-out cap. She had clearly never thought of a cap and thought of this issue 2 minutes before this question came her way. But she kind of went, yeah, I guess there's a number that's too big. What number for an injury, for a quality of life, is too much? She went, $2 million? And I was like, you know, I liked her. I think she's a good juror. I think she cares about a pedestrian case. I think she had good answers on those. I think that she's, I don't think it was a well-thought-out answer. And so I convinced her to keep the juror. I said, we could probably get her for cause, but don't go after her for cause. Keep her. We kept her on the jury. And she actually wanted to give them, she wanted to give like $20 million at the end of the case. You know, the same juror that said she had a cap supposedly of $2 million. And so the whole point of me telling you this is that, like, you know, these jurors, I mean, we expect these jurors to have well thought out opinions that are about damages, even though they never thought about these things. And so sometimes jurors' kind of gut reaction at the beginning is not really how they are going to be at the end of the case. And so that's why I kind of worry a little bit about giving a number and giving them some reason to tell you, oh, I could never give you that much money, because they haven't heard how injured the person is or how egregious the conduct was or whatever. So, but I would never say don't do it, because I've seen some lawyers do a great job of doing exactly that.
I always get worried sometimes in giving a specific number that sometimes it just depends how the evidence comes out too, you know, especially on the non-economic damages and the whole body of evidence and how the jury's responding to it. So, I mean, you could run the risk of actually communicating something to a jury and wishing you actually wanted to ask for more and could have gotten more for your client.
Yeah, no, I had picked a jury a couple of years ago with a friend of mine, and he gave a number in opening. I think he said it was going to be like $6.5 million. And the trial went really well. I love the jury. The trial went really well. And he, at the end, he decided he's going to ask for more. He asked for like $8.5 million, and the jurors gave 6.5, and they were mad at him. And they were like, they told him, and they said, we're holding you to what you said. They were like, you know, they were angry that he asked for more money. They probably would have given it if he hadn't mentioned that number at the beginning. So it's just funny. But I remember another trial, I was picking a jury years ago, I think in their mini opening, the defense started talking about how the plaintiff was suing for $10 million in this, and it was an employment case, sexual harassment employment case, and the person really didn't have any economic damages. She'd find another job really quickly. And I guess the $10 million had been in a filing or something like that, and like an official filing in the case, which was really strange. And the jurors were just so angry about it. The reason for that is they just feel like if you give a number before they know the reason, even though you know the reason, they feel like sometimes they think it's arbitrary. And of course, it's not arbitrary, and you know the case and everything, but they just don't get it. They're just going, how could you be asking for that money? We don't know what the case is about. Well, so I just remember we just lost so many jurors, and so many jurors were just so angry that we were supposedly asking for $10 million, even though we hadn't even said a number yet.
We're coming up on the hour, but I have two kind of final questions from my perspective that I wanted to ask you. One is, how important do you think it is to have you there present during the jury selection process to assist the lawyer in kind of reading body language and interpreting the answers? That's question one. Question two is, What is it like to run a business together with your wife, and how do you divide up the responsibilities? And if we could only hire one of you, which one should we hire?
So the first one, I think it's critically important to have me there. In fact, these days, I don't really work on cases unless I'm going to be there for jury selection, because every case that I take, I'm being more selective and trying to do quality over quantity of cases. And so I want to see it through. I want the best possible jury. And I've just found over the years that even when I write the voir dire questions for somebody and I kind of talk to them about the kind of jurors, the lawyer ends up assessing the jurors very differently. I remember I was, just probably 6 months ago, or January this year, I was picking a jury and I was trying to get the lawyer to ask a really important question. And he finally asked the question to one person and he got like the best A+ response, but the person was really angry. They weren't angry at him. They were just like, absolutely, of course, and whatever. And the lawyer got really apologetic and thought he wanted a striker. And so for me, I think I do need to, the questions that I write are really for me to assess the answers. And a lot of lawyers, I think, assess them a very different way. And so it's really, I think it's critical for me. I don't really work on cases where I just write voir dire and say, hey, good luck picking the jury. I think it really makes a huge difference for me to be there assessing them. The second question, I did not meet my wife jury consulting. We were already married when I was already a jury consultant. She would help me, at focus groups, kind of like rounding up the jurors and doing all those things and everything. And she eventually decided she wanted to do it too. So I trained her for a few years. So really it's the way that we do it, we have totally separate caseloads and, a lot of times separate clients. We may sometimes cover for one another if one of us can't be there or gets stuck in a double booked in another trial. But really bringing her in was really my attempt to clone myself as I could, because I wouldn't have to turn down as many cases if I was already in another trial. But she does an awesome job. I mean, she's incredible and she's intuitive in some ways that I'm not. So we probably spend more time than we should talking shop instead of talking about, marriage, personal things. But it's we're just both competitive people. And so I love to see her do well and love to bounce ideas off her in my cases too.
Oh, Ben, he totally didn't answer the question.
Oh, the last question. Oh, who they should.
I'm striking him for cause. Don't worry.
Right. I forgot that. Well, there's a part B of that question.
We know what the answer will be.
Yeah.
I would say hire her. I would say hire her. Here's why. She is a lot more, probably didn't used to be this way 10 years ago. She is a lot more patient with lawyers and new lawyers, and she's a lot more nice to them. If they're, I get a little more frustrated if it's like, no, you're not getting it. You're not asking this question the right way. You're not doing this. Now she's better at cracking the whip than me. I'll just roll my eyes and get really annoyed or whatever. But so for somebody who has not worked with a jury consultant before and needs a little bit more patience and explanation, probably Claire is probably the better choice.
That was kind of an answer.
Great answer. That's going to extend the marriage. So congrats on that, Harry.
Thank you. Yes.
Well, we really appreciate your time today. If folks are interested in talking to you more or your services, how do they find you?
Sure. So they can shoot me an email, give me a call. My website with all that information is yournextjury.com. It's got my email, phone number. It's got articles and all kinds of things on there. So that's probably the best way to get in touch with me, or they can email me at harry@yournextjury.com.
Harry, fascinating. Thank you so much for joining us.
I hope Rahul will make you a nice breakfast now.
After his blood tests.
Oh, I got to get my blood draw first. Yeah. Well, thanks so much for having me. You guys are the best. I'm looking forward to seeing this and watching other ones. And you guys do a great job. It's a pleasure being on here.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us.
For more information about today's guests and the topics discussed on the show, please visit our website at www.elevate.net. That's ELAWBATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes, and you can continue the conversation by joining our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope that you'll subscribe and consider giving us a 5-star review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your trial law practice, and we'll see you back again soon.